From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Groundsman. I stand here in the middle with my two fellow layabouts, all leaning on our rakes, Giles Morgan and Roger Mitchell. Fellas, welcome.
Hi there, Grant. How are you doing?
Very, very well, Giles.
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm strong. I'm looking forward to Christmas. I've been doing a lot of Christmas shopping, elbows out, barging old people out the way, and I think I've got all of the top presents and... If that's not COVID compliant, well, I'm sorry, but I needed a lot of mouths to feed.
You've heard of this thing called Amazon.com, right?
Is that isn't that where Wonder Woman was from?
I was going to say other home delivery things are available, but let's face it, pretty much they're not.
They are.
So,
no, I'm not that much of a posh twat that I like to go to Peter Jones in West London and wrestle with middle class ladies.
Okay, fair enough.
That's the new Olympic sport.
If you wouldn't mind, Giles, just giving your address for the Notting Hill Police, so they know where to find you.
They can find me on the Reeve Go, sailing up and down the Thames.
All right, excellent. Well, gentlemen, as always, never a dull moment and never a quiet week in sport. There's so much going on at the moment. It's hard to know where to start. I just want to, seeing as many of these weeks we seem to be giving stick to Fulham, Rog, I want to just step in here after yesterday and say two things, actually, about the game yesterday. First of all, Fulham were robbed. Any scouts listening, don't even bother coming back with anything. We should have won that game. But the most remarkable thing, I read a review, I think it was in the Times, of the match, talking about the cacophonous noise from Fulham fans. Now, I've been going to Craven Cottage since the early 1970s, and I can promise you there has never, ever been a cacophonous noise at Craven Cottage. So something must have happened because apparently the 2,000 fans sounded like 20, and that's 20,000 as opposed to 20.
Amazing. I mean, it was a good game. The stadium's looking good, Grant. It's looking nice. Liverpool looked flat, and you guys... Kind of, you put in a journeyman performance that, yeah, fine, it was okay.
Come on. All the weeks I sit here and pour my heart out. You can't let me have this one moment.
That was great. No, it was great. And I actually thought you should have had that penalty as well. It was very interesting. Yeah. From the different angles, it looked yes, no, no, yes. So it just shows you that it's even with VAR, it's not easy. But I thought you should have taken 3 points.
Yeah, never mind. Anyway, I had to get that out of the way because poor Fulham, it's not often they give me a chance.
We did have Salah as our captain on the fantasy thing. So that penalty just worked a treat for us, Grant, let's be honest.
Well, us. Let's define us, shall we?
We've got a 55-point lead.
let's put my beloved Fulham aside and talk about things more broader in scope. And there's something I want to bring up first. I know this is something that you two have mentioned, and I suspect it will take us down a rabbit hole of sorts, and that is the announcement this week about the admission of breakdancing into the Olympics. Now, I'd like to get your opinions on this, the pair of you, because I'm sorry. I just don't see breakdancing as an Olympic sport. I was going to say it's not really a sport, but I'll temper that. But breakdancing in the Olympics, seriously, is that, are you of a similar mind to me, gents, or are you all for it? I know, Giles, back in the day, you were a sporter of the odd gold chain and loosely fitting tracksuit, but what do you think of this?
Well, on a personal level, I feel it gives me a chance to claim Olympic glory in the future. So I'm all for it.
Giles, you do know breakdancing has nothing to do with your hips, right? At your age, it's the only thing you got a chance of breaking dancing.
Well, here's what I think. And I've been thinking a lot about this. I suspect a lot of people in the sports world and fans of sport have all been thinking, which on the outset, it looks ridiculous because breakdancing, particularly in that sense of anything that is artistic, you've got that sense of, well, how can that be pure competition when there's interpretation? But of course, in the Olympics, particularly the Winter Olympics with ice dancing or whatever, that's already a road that's been travelled and been very successful. We don't decry Torvald and Dean for what they did in Sarajevo in 1984. On the
You're
other
talking
hand,
Bolero now.
We are talking Bolero, and that was one of my, I remember it well. I was 13, and it was at that moment as I was becoming a young man. Let's just put it and stop there.
let's
just stop there. What I think is interesting is I understand what the IOC, and particularly I know the French are keen to do. They're obviously trying to get to a younger audience, like they have done very successfully in the Winter Games, I would argue. I think the Olympics has really stolen a march with the younger audience, with Snowcross and all the rest of it. The trouble with this is, one, by being called breakdancing, even though I think they're calling it breaking or something, they're taking dance out of the title, it puts itself up for ridicule, and I suspect we are all doing the same. And secondly, it looks to me like they're chasing rather than leading. And this is what worries me more. The International Olympic movement is all about the bastion of sport worldwide. And of course, they have to move with tide and they have to move with wind as trend changes and people and consumption changes. But this looks to, I think on the outside, and obviously we haven't spoken to the IOC or people about it, it looks like they're chasing an audience rather than trying to lead and galvanize an audience. And I think for that reason, I'm skeptical. Not because they're not trying to engage, because they have done it with the winter sports very well. And I think that's probably helped the movement a lot. But this feels like it could get ridiculed before they've even had a chance to perhaps properly put it through. Because there's no doubt the athleticism of breakdancing, like any dancing or movement and gymnastics, is hugely impressive. But you lay yourself up for ridicule. And so I'm interested to see this one play out.
Raj, what are your thoughts?
I think I kind of agree with that. You know, I'm resisting going down the line of, well, did I not tell you this was the way things were going? Look to find where audiences are, as opposed to setting out your stall and hoping they come. It's in the same theme that we've discussed. I won't go back there. I just think the whole IOC world, which I do not know a lot about, I must admit, it's not been something I've known a lot about, but the whole IOC world and how it finances the long tail of sports and international federations, I think is going to become a big, big issue. Because, you know, when everything that we've talked about happens in the business models of sport, you know, there's a whole lot of sports that basically take that dowry every four years, and it keeps them alive. And I think that's made them lazy. I think it's made them not willing to see what the real niche audience is, because they've had the sugar daddy that's just paid them a lot of money. And I think that cold shower is coming.
Well, and it's interesting, Roger. I have a few as well. Is obviously the history of sport has moved on enormously in the last 5 years, let alone the last 20, from when a lot of the modern sports governing bodies came to be initially in the sort of turn of the 20th century, and then building and building up. And governance has changed, and the very purpose of them has changed. And what you talk a lot about on the various shows that we do on Are You Not Entertained is that sport has to be able to be dynamic. It has to follow the audience, and it has to adapt. And we talk about adapt and die and Darwinism a lot on this show. For me, particularly when we talk about sport as entertainment rather than sport as authentic competition, and for the old guard, if you like, probably all of us to an extent, but probably Grant and I the most, is that we really feel that competition is absolutely at the heart of what real sport is all about. And exhibitionism or absurd sport doesn't necessarily, it may capture the imagination of the young for now, but what will that look like in the future? And is it a flimsy foundation? For me, the IOC, you were both willing me to get to the point there, so I did get there in the end. For me, the IOC have an opportunity to modernise themselves to be the bastion of what authentic sport should be, and to maybe toss away some of the blazers and the cronyism, and to start thinking about what does the IOC do? Because the values of Olympism are wonderful, but also protection of what is authentic in sport, I think, doesn't mean that sport can't be entertainment either. It just means there is a separation, and that they become the if you like, the executive that talk about what is authentic sport. Because I worry so much that, you know, we look at the boxing, and I know we'll talk about that probably a little bit later. I understand why we're getting these huge numbers, and I understand entertainment. Wrestling invented this a long, long time ago of sport for entertainment. But I do worry that if you start to blur the lines, particularly in something like the Olympics, where, let's be honest, most of the sports are pretty bloody boring for 4 years, none of them watch any of them, and then you watch a binary event and you realise that you're watching athlete A and athlete B who have trained all their lives for this one moment, and it is success or failure or gold and silver, bronze or whatever you like, you're watching something that is extraordinarily powerful in a human sense, which is not about the fame, it's not about the money, it's not about that, it's just about the winning, the losing, and the endurance that that's created, that pinnacle. And when sport starts to bastardize itself and to become a show, then I worry what sport is really for. And I think from a philosophical point of view, sport, I was watching a film the other day, The Running Man, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, which some of you may remember. Yeah, yeah. And obviously he's wearing Lycra, and it's not a great look.
When you say the other day, Giles, you mean 1987?
No, well, no, I was going back through the back catalogue. But I was seeking
bizarre.
That film. I was seeking the film out actually for this thought, which is so often Hollywood does actually, and literature even more so, predicts a future. Think
100%.
Think 1984. Think Terminator, think all of these things, is where the imagination of mankind predicts a future that then becomes the reality. Well, The Running Man, no one's dying and no one's being shot to die, all the rest of it. But a bit like The Truman Show, you can kind of see where they're going. And I think sport is running the risk, or could run the risk, of becoming absurd for the sake of entertainment. And I feel that the IOC, God bless them in Lausanne, those coughing blazers could actually put on some tracksuits and protect sport.
Charles, interestingly enough, you chose wrestling there. Now, wrestling was one of the original games of the Olympiad, right? And here it is.
Still is,
today.
I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm saying it's been there from year one, right? But it hasn't changed. The wrestling you get at the Olympics is wrestling. It's not the nonsense of the WWE. It's not that stage-managed, hyped-up drivel. Frankly, I apologize to wrestling fans, but come on, seriously. So it just shows you that sport doesn't need to be about entertainment to be included. You know, and when we talk about breakdancing, you know, I remember back in the 80s where they would somehow shoehorn a cliff of people breakdancing into every movie that was put out for, you know, 10 years, right? Because it was cool and it was
Clash
and it was
dance,
trendy,
yeah.
Whatever, right? And even if it wasn't about dancing, there'd be someone walking down the street corner and there'd be a couple of people with a torn up cardboard box breakdancing, right? I haven't seen, given social media, my feed has not been inundated with people saying, look at this amazing breakdancer. I've seen as much Morris dancing as I have breakdancing in my Twitter feed. So I'm really curious about this. I mean, genuinely curious because, it doesn't feel to me like there's been a resurgence of breakdancing. It doesn't feel, and I could be completely off the market, and I'm willing to be told I am, but I would imagine if it had been resurgent, I would have seen clips of it.
Again, this is the problem, and in a former life, I was quite involved in the Olympics before HSBC, and it wasn't the ancient Olympics before anybody pipes up. But what's very interesting is that the lobbying required to get a sport into the Olympics is as political as lobbying to get a city involved in the Olympic Games. It isn't necessarily done for all the right reasons. I would argue that some of the right sports that have been allowed the golden ticket into the Olympic family have not been necessarily the ones that justified it the most, but have
somehow... Hang on. Are you telling me that big breakdance is behind this? Because I just refuse to believe it. I mean, this is...
Did you not read Orwell? If you take Orwell and then you just twist it a bit, you get to breakdancing.
Seriously, who's lobbying for breakdancing? I mean, why is Michael Flatley not representing to the IOC? Because there's a guaranteed gold medal for Ireland, for a start.
you will find that breakdancing will have, and I'm not sure which if they're part of one of the federations, they will have done an alliance maybe with gymnastics or something like that to get in. But the amount of politicking, softball has had a go and failed, baseball obviously, there's been a whole lot.
Taekwondo, it's a nonsense.
And it's what I mean is I'm all for sports coming in. So on the flip side, things like snowcross and snowboarding and all that cool stuff that went into, which all came out of the X Games, the IOC were really smart. They got on board and they got those sports in, and I think really galvanized the Winter Olympics for the younger audience. Because if you're a youngster now and snowboarding's your thing and you won an Olympic gold, that is as cool. That is still the pinnacle of the sport, and that's credibility. The trouble is that too many of the other sports, as you get, it's the fucking corridors of power again that get in the way. And I've seen it firsthand of watching the lobbying, because remember, I was pretty close to rugby and golf during that whole process in 2008, 2009, 2010, when both those sports got into the Olympic Games. And I was very supportive of that and remain very supportive of that, though I'd like to talk about rugby because it's sevens that's the key. But my God, the fight that needed to happen when you could say, well, this is the right thing to do, let's just do it, rather than to go through the process. But the Olympics is all about process. It's all about voting. And if you look at the membership of the IOC, well, let's put it this way, you might not invent it if you were starting from scratch.
Yeah, right.
Well, I agree with all of that. I would just, you know, my belief in things, it's just follow the money. And you know, the Olympics have got a deal with Discovery. They did a big deal with Discovery a few years ago, and just look what Discovery's done this week. You know, they've thrown together Eurosport with the other Discovery Plus properties, and the article caught my eye for a quote. Quoting now, one of the big opportunities that I see is that overlapping audience between more general entertainment, broader audience, and the sport-specific audience is the future. So, you know, somebody somewhere in Lausanne says, well, maybe we should get something cool. And to your point, Grant, these people are so old that they think breakdancing is cool. Because they haven't seen it, you know, like that, you know, so it's a knee jerk to try and do something that everybody's talking about. And I just look at the whole IOC thing. You know, they make a huge amount of money. They cream 10% off the top to pay themselves. And then the rest of it goes somewhere that is unclear, but it does finance a lot of sports that are not really in anybody's radar for 4 years. That's just not sustainable.
Well,
it's not sustainable.
The big trouble is, right, and I understand this, and this, I don't have the solution. The trouble is, to become an Olympic sport, one of the things that you have to demonstrate as that sport is that you are going to globalize the sport, and you're going to take the game, the sport that you're in, all over the world, and that you've got a plan to do that, which is all very noble in a world of globalism. Right, which says, yes, we've got a membership in Uganda and one in, I don't know, Sri Lanka or someone like that. And this is one of the problems that I have with sports, is that and I think the IOC unwittingly drive this. I don't think they're doing it for sinister reasons. But why should a sport be global? Why should rugby union hemorrhage, as World Rugby do, so much money, having to try and create rugby unions in different countries around the world in order to keep their membership, when in fact very few people are playing? And actually, wouldn't it be better for the 20, 25, 30 countries that play it properly and it'd be properly funded? And if that doesn't mean the Olympics, that doesn't mean the Olympics. Because the hemorrhaging of money in sport, which we talk about all the time with commercialism, is sport that's diluted is a loss leader. And if you like, take the American model, where the big four sports they have over there, they don't really give a toss about the rest of the world. But my God, they're big international sports, and they have huge followings. Why is global? And this is a question: why is global important? Because particularly with what this year has been with COVID, particularly with how things are changing, do we always need to be global? Is a question I'd put out there.
You're right, Giles, but listen, you know, the IOC is the ultimate bundled product, isn't it? You know, you're getting your value from what? Track and field, probably certainly the 100 metres, bit of swimming. You know the point I'm making. And then the monies from that are trickled down to sports that have not, quotes, deserved that level of revenue because their audience doesn't deserve it. I just look at the whole damn thing, and the sooner they realise that and get every sport earning its own way, deciding whether it's real, deciding whether it's got a future. You look at table tennis, they're starting to get their act together. You look at lacrosse, and it was the individual athlete that said, no, I need to do it better. The IOC is holding back sport, Giles.
Well, and you're right. I mean, table tennis is a wonderful example of a sport that is one of the most followed sports in the world, particularly with its massive Asian audience. And they've
badminton too,
and both sports have galvanized and are galvanizing themselves to say, we have got a fan diaspora, a universe that makes us far more powerful than we ever believed possible. And this goes back to data, which I know I bang on about all the time, but both sports have realized that their value is their fan base at the heart of the sport. I talk about that the whole time. And in fact, you're exactly right. The sports that are going to say, who are we and who are our followers, and let's understand who we are then able to say, what do we want to be in the future? And that could be global. And track and field, the IAA, or the World Athletics, as they're called now, will always be and should actually be at the forefront of the Olympic movement. But there are plenty of sports, I think, that probably don't need to be Olympic sports that would fare better without.
But what about something like kabaddi? Right? I mean, here's a sport
that is massive
in the subcontinent. It's a fantastic game to watch.
Love that.
It's kind of comical in a way when you first see it. But it's in the Asian Games. They have a World Cup. There's billions of people that are fans and millions of people that play it. Why are we not seeing something like that promoted to the full Olympics instead of something like breakdancing?
I don't disagree with that, but then kabaddi, in order to get membership, then have to take the game global, rather than saying that we are a massive sport within India, particularly within the subcontinent, which it is, one of the very top sports. You know, I think cricket, badminton, kabaddi are the big three in India, particularly in a world where nothing is very global. It's not like you can't switch on the telly and watch something all over the world and get straight in. Why does it need to be represented in every country? Why can't we just enjoy kabaddi for kabaddi's sake with their Premier League that they have there? And if you want to watch the best of the best, watch it there. That would be my argument. Cricket's another. Cricket is not a global game. Cricket is played by the residue of the British Empire. And that happens to be about a third of the world's population because of India. And it works. It works just fine. And I get to watch the IPL, then I watch the Big Bash in Australia, then I get to watch whatever we have, the 100 and so on over here in the UK. My cricket diet is well stocked. I don't need it to be a global sport to be any better.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, fair enough. Well, I guess the moral of the story, Giles, is you have to take the good with the kabaddi, I presume.
Jesus, Grant. What did you have for breakfast today?
I thought he had a pint of Guinness. For those of you, this is an audio show, but we look at each other over video, and Grant held up this sort of cloudy glass, and I thought, and he's based in the Cayman Islands, and I thought he was on Guinness at 8 o'clock in the morning, which would have been a good Christmas effort.
No, it was a very large coffee. Maybe that's what it is, Raj. But Raj, what I know you've got a load of stuff on your radar that you want to. I was going to use the word bang on about them, but I'm going to say talk about just to give you a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. And the challenge these days is the filter and what you talk about.
Do you have a filter, Roger?
Yeah. How's that challenge for you?
What?
The challenge for you is trying to find one.
I've not met your filter.
Well, not about then what I say, about what I choose to say. That's my filter, what gets through to the show. And up until yesterday, probably this wasn't going to make it. And then it is going to make it because one I would like to talk about is the wonderful ad that we saw Adidas do in conjunction with Arsenal Football Club.
Yes.
Then and now, which I think, you know, this program, as Joe says, maybe, you know, veers very often to the, you know, the data over the art side of the debate. So I thought, well, here I'm going to take it back a little bit and talk about just pure creativity, the choice of the music. And I thought that ad was lovely because there was, I felt anyway, obviously creative things appeal to people in different ways. I felt there was a whole theme about the world has changed. Have you changed? Football has changed. Have you changed? Are you still in the old 80s? Do you still like the generation game? Or are you really embracing the new world? And I thought it was great. I really thought it was great. And I said, in the conclusion of a tweet exchange around that, I said, you know, the problem is all the greatest minds about brand, about corporate, even about global, they've got nowhere to go if the underlying team performance or the individual performance isn't backing it up. And I guess that introduces me to the theme, which is the uncontrollability of football. All of us talk a great game, and there's a million articles out there now. There's one every day, how to run a modern football club, how to do it, what's the strategy, what are the pillars, your 10 axioms to be a global, you know, super group of clubs. It's all bollocks. It's all bollocks. You cannot do it unless you are prepared to accept a level of volatility, and this is your world, Grant, vol is so high that unless you can think that you're going to accept it, you shouldn't get it in the first place. And I'm talking about yesterday, Arsenal again losing, and then what I saw on Arsenal Fan TV and the rest of the Twitter feed that was glorious in its absurdity. But my point was, none of those people venting their spleen on social media last night were thinking that that was a great choice of music for the Adidas ad for Arsenal. And that's what's on my mind today, Grant.
I couldn't agree more, Roger. I think you've got into a lot of trouble in the past, in the early days of this show, talking about quote unquote football fans and why they're different, but the reality is you're absolutely right, and particularly around the big clubs, you know, the Arsenals, the Man Uniteds of the world, these clubs believe they are supposed to win, and they're supposed to win trophies, and they're supposed to be successful. And you know, United's is the classic example, right? I mean, the Glazers out stuff, when did that all start, right? You know, it started when they weren't winning. And it got really nasty. You know, Chelsea, they've given Abramovich some stick. Arsenal have turned on Kroenke, whatever his name is. Yeah. I always forget how you pronounce it.
Kroenke.
But then you take it down a notch to the Fulhams of the world. You know, Al Fayed took some stick for a time, despite having saved the club from extinction, basically. Right? He literally saved the club from extinction. And yet when the team got relegated, which you'd think you'd be used to as a Fulham fan by now, they turn on Al Fayed. You know, he's not spending enough money. The same with Shahid Khan, right? Same thing. You're not spending enough money, or you spent too much money when he got Fulham promoted to the Premier League, right? There is no way of connecting with what is, in effect, a tribal audience.
Feral. Feral is the adjective.
Yeah, okay,
you cannot
fine.
Control you, it.
Yeah, no, you can't.
You can't control it.
It's wonderful when it's working out. But
wonderful,
but,
yeah.
Roger, what I will say, though, is if you beat out that winning expectation over long enough years, and I'm talking about you, Sunderland, you get to the point where, despite all the awful stuff that went on in the first season of that show and watching them get relegated, you know, Sunderland Till I Die, when we click into the first episode of season two, the fans can't wait to get back in the ground again. It's all forgotten, you know.
It's total irrationality.
Completely.
That's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of it. And my point is we're applying fucking Harvard Business School theory and verbiage to what basically is total irrationality. And I want to say that because I'm fed up reading these articles about how to do it and how it's possible. It isn't possible. If you're not winning, you're in serious trouble. And, you know, that's what sport, so I'm talking about football. That's what football needs to get its head around. You know, I've called it in the past, it's basically nothing more than the owner, leave your credit card behind the bar. Just leave it, and you get to hang out with the cool lads. You get to be one of them. You never were probably when you were young yourself. That's why you bought your football club. You get to hang out with them. They'll tolerate you as long as you've left the credit card behind the bar. But see, when you're not, it's maxed out, fuck off. You know, it's as simple as that. And, you know, that's why yesterday, the first part of it, I thought that is a great ad. I love that. The music choice was really beautiful. I loved the messaging. And then Arsenal Fan TV, I thought, nah, you know, what are we doing here? Giles, what do you think, mate?
Well, it's interesting. On any sport, I've talked about, particularly in the sponsor world, which obviously is my world, where brands dance with the devil. And sometimes people talk about symbiotic marketing. I used to in my most pompous best. Or you could call it more cynically parasitical marketing, where the sponsor is the parasite, which is a bit negative because with a parasite you benefit and the host gets detraction, and I'm not sure that happens. But what is interesting to me, it's mutualism, where you have a sponsor that comes in and puts money into whatever it may be that sponsor, but let's use football for this example. But you are dancing with the devil, and like the plover bird that cleans the crocodile's teeth, every now and then the jaws come down and the plover bird is no longer. And that's what happens. And I think the allure for sponsors who are basically, I've always said this, it's basically boring, big commercial brands are trying to differentiate. What is exciting? What could be more exciting than the tribalism of football, of the binary win-lose, of that fandom, of all of the things that represents? But at the same time, that feral nature that comes through is always going to be the price of admission. And you either accept it or you leave well alone. But what you don't do as a big corporate brand is then moan when it happens, because it does happen. I always remember when Tiger Woods fell from grace for a little while, and it used to amuse me because I've worked with Tiger Woods before. That didn't amuse me what he was doing, but it was this, all over the airports, all over the world. Accenture had their signs up at the time.
Yep.
Go on, beer tiger. And I was thinking, wow, that is real permission. But and then they had to review everything. Well, there's always risk of backing anything in sport. In fact, backing anything with human beings comes with risk, because humans, thank God, are not perfect, and we're not from planet Vulcan like Roger is. So it's got to be, for brands, you've got to understand that, particularly in football, that you go in, but you have to have your eyes wide open, because there's going to be the feral nature, but you'll get your highs as well. So I've been fascinated. I've always loved Adidas's, and in fact Nike's output in general. I love it when they go edgy. Those are the brands in sponsorship world are always the ones that are closest to sport, obviously, because their direct consumer is the sports fan. Therefore, they research it. And do you know what? Every rights holder in the world would be very, very well advised to employ anybody who works for a Nike or an Adidas into their marketing department to actually understand consumer, because that's where it all hands all lies. But I think where you do see brands who throw their corporate hands up in horror when someone has been caught spitting or shagging someone or doing something and go, oh, we can't abide with that. Well, what did you expect? Get over yourself.
Yeah, well, Giles, it's not just the sponsors. And this one's a little bit of a prickly one, but it needs to be said. There was a whole thing in the last month or so about those multicolored captains armbands, you know, that are the support for LGBT community. And there was this lovely video, which I really liked. You know, I think it was Henderson at Liverpool was replying to somebody who said that, you know, they really loved, you know, that gesture and what it meant to them. And I get behind that completely, 100% completely. But do you know what? Go and see if that messaging is on the social media geographical sites of those clubs in certain other countries.
Yeah.
And you know the countries I'm talking about is the ones that aren't as advanced in terms of LGBT. So you have got rights holders, classically virtue signaling, and they all do it and they all love it and they all feel good about themselves. But then they get their little hat on and they say, well, yeah, you know, that billion of fans we've got in Southeast Asia, I'm not sure they're ready for that yet, so we'll just let it go. This is the hypocrisy that's around. And it's around everywhere, and nobody is going to call it because nobody wants to be seen to be not on the virtue signaling bandwagon.
And that is entirely true with many multinational corporations as well, where they're absolutely in the markets where they should and could be doing and virtue signaling and saying that they've got everybody's best interests at heart, which is true, except where they're not. And it's a problem. And I think corporations get themselves into really difficult situations because there is not one rule for one in different countries around the world. And yet in a global village that we live where media goes everywhere and sport is as ubiquitous and universal as anything out there, is to proudly promote that, you know, that you're for gender equality, which is absolutely right. And we all believe in that, but there are places in the world that don't. And then they may find that they're not being quite as noisy about that. So it's an issue that sport has. And I always worry about it. I've always been just such a massive sort of adherent of Simon Barnes and his writing. I love the fact that sport is a distraction. I love the fact that sport is inconsequential. And I would love to just be in a world where it's just about the win and loss and not sort of trying to carry the banner of absolutely everything, because you can't win by carrying all the banners. You can't, because there's always someone who's offended, always.
Yeah. On a lighter note, just to end that little chapter, coming back to Arsenal last night, I didn't know this, but when I was watching the rants, one of the Arsenal boys brought Bellerin into the conversation. It wasn't his fault last night. He wasn't sent off, but obviously he's one of these fans that just doesn't like Bellerin. That happens. It happens a lot. So he was his man. So he said, Bellerin can't pass the ball, can't do anything. You should never wear an Arsenal shirt again. And I'll remove all the expletives. Why don't you just go and plant a tree? And I thought, what? Quick Google search, Bellerin tree planting. You know, and in the summer, he's come out and said every win for Arsenal, he's going to plant 3,000 trees or something like that. And it was like on Davos website and World Economic Forum. What do the fans care when they're not winning about the virtue signaling or the tree hugging?
Yeah,
nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing. Just golden comedy.
Well, Rog, what else was on your radar this week? I know you were having a particularly rant-filled week this week.
No, it's not rant-filled. I'll amuse you a little bit with a quick one on baseball and pandemic insurance. You may not be aware that there's a huge, I mean talking billions, legal case going on just now where the MLB, the governing body of baseball, believes that they took out the appropriate insurance cover. And the insurance, no shit, Sherlock, disagree. And if you're reading this article, it is unbelievable. I mean, the lawyers, what a profession. Forgive me, I know a lot of nice lawyers that listen to this. Forgive me, but it is one hell of a profession. You know, the MLB, in the complaint against insurers, quote, specifically insure against physical loss or damage arising from communicable disease caused by a virus. That sounds pretty good to me, no?
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward.
Apparently not. The insurance companies in the past have relied on the defence of applicable exclusions, and this is the whole thing, applicable exclusions, and a multi-billion dollar lawsuit is coming down to the use of the word or and around damage and loss. And I mean, we're not lawyers, we can't comment on this, but I mean, it's astonishing. You know, like, you've got the MLB who, in the view of the man on the top of the Clapham omnibus, has covered themselves prudently and well, and the insurance companies are like just going on the definition of a word. It's astonishing. Astonishing story.
I've had the same problem with my Bupa insurance.
Well, so let's go back. What, 20 plus 22 years to the Clinton Lewinsky thing, right?
It's a bit like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is. It depends on what your definition of the word is. I mean, yeah. There's always some way you can try and wriggle out of these things, but you end up looking. Less than wholesome, let's put it that way. But look, with the money at stake with these things, yeah, no, of course.
But this is serious stuff. Serious stuff. I mean, baseball is the fabric of American society. Mom and apple pie, Field of Dreams. Baseball's important, you know, socially. And, you know, they're not getting any help here. This seems to be like, you know, dog eat dog and like whatever. I just read it as a non-lawyer and I am flabbergasted that what they thought they bought is not appropriate. Unbelievable.
And yet, on the flip side, and it's been so important, you think of the All England Championship.
Exactly.
At Wimbledon, who this year in 2020 had the foresight to take out that insurance 20 years ago, which happened after SARS. I understand it. They took out a part of their policy, which was really based on the rain delay, which was obviously a part of Wimbledon for their own commercial model back in, before the roofs were built. And thank goodness, because they were fully protected on COVID this year. And I imagine, hoping very much, that it won't happen next year. Because
well, so the premiums will have gone up beyond beyond anything reasonable. Well, we touched on boxing earlier on. And obviously, there's an awful lot going on in the boxing world at the moment. And Rog, this is something you know you've been all over with the influencers
inevitable
jumping in.
Inevitable.
Obviously, Logan Paul. I forget which one of these influences. Logan Paul and Nate Robinson. You know, we've spoken about. There's now talk that
Jake Paul.
Well, whichever one of the Pauls. One of the Pauls. But there's talk now that one of them is going to fight, is it Roy Jones or Floyd Mayweather? Mayweather, probably.
Mayweather, yeah. But it's all getting amalgamated into what Joe Markovsky guest on the show, and DAZN obviously are the key players in the whole boxing thing, is saying is unsatisfied demand from the public for boxing. And because of that, it has been filled by celebrity. I think that's quite cute PR. I don't actually agree with that. I think it's two separate things. I believe people just want to see famous people getting knocked flat in their face. It's simple as that. I don't think it's anything about the beautiful game of boxing. Although then you take the other side, you've got Anthony Joshua. Obviously, the Tyson Fury fight is getting much closer. They're starting the trash talk already. I'm still very bullish in boxing, but it should embrace this celebrity thing. It shouldn't, you know, get into this.
Also the sport has to be so careful, right? These celebrities coming in, and we're seeing it with rugby union. People are going to get hurt, and when people get hurt, it's going to change things again. And I
that's true.
And I worry so much. I this kind of theatrical, it's almost pantomime sport, and I know they're taking it seriously, but boxing has always been very licensed. It's been heavily licensed as a sport for the last 15-20 years. It's bloody dangerous, and as rugby union is discovering to its cost, that if you're not properly protected, there is big trouble coming ahead. And I just worry. It infuriates me. I understand exactly why all of the celebrity boxing is happening. And my son, who's 16, was telling me all about it at the weekend, and he loves it. So I understand why.
There you go.
Right, he loves it. I'm still not sure. But
well, listen,
go.
Rog, let's in the 70s and 80s, Ronnie Corbett never got hurt playing pro celebrity golf, did he? Let's face it. So there is a place for pro celebrity sport, but does it? I mean, look, I noticed that Mayweather has included the knockout of Conor McGregor in his stats, right? So
yeah.
You know, he's now 52-1 or whatever he is, right? So, but if Jake Paul lands a stray punch and just manages to flatten him, do you think that's going to get counted? Do you think he'll be 51-2?
No. I think it's a zero he's got. I think he's undefeated, Grant, but I take your point. No, yeah, and you're right, he won't. But listen, let's not lose Giles's point there, because I think that probably is the story of the week. You know, I came across the story, I think it was in The Guardian, and, you know, we've had the heading thing and Jeff Astle. And then these two stories come out. One, you know, Jamie Johnston, he's a former player. He told The Guardian that he could not, quotes, encourage school children to play the game in its current form, talking about rugby. That's dramatic. I mean, that's dramatic. We all know that the power is increasing as professionalism, that those hits are huge. But now you've got, what is the fabric of a lot of the school system in UK, rugby, the playing of rugby, and an ex-player saying he can no longer encourage school children to play the game. And you know, it's just me, my background. I read that and I thought, my first thought, CVC. Did you see this coming? Did you put that into your risk analysis of when you do a big investment like this? I think this is the biggest story of the week.
I agree, Rog, and I think whilst I know that World Rugby have been talking about a lot of the concussion issues in the sport, certainly since I was involved with World Rugby for the last 10 years, and it has been something I don't think anybody quite realised, although I think we probably all used to say it in the pub, in the 4 or 5 years after professionalism in 1995, if you start to look at the physicality of the professional game, how it changed and has just grown and grown in terms of the individuals playing, the size of the, let's just talk about the men's game here, and I'm not, this is a gender thing, it's just if you look at the professional male game, the sort of hits from the sort of size of people compared to if you go back into the amateur era, yeah, and playing in the 60s, 70s, 80s,
yeah,
it is a completely different ball game. And the human body, that not enough research has been done on that power ratio of people coming in. And yes, they've been working so hard on the tackle height and all of the rest of it, but you're still having human beings often in the sort of 17, 18, 19 stone coming in with hits that would never have happened in a previous era. And this was always going to happen. And I don't mean that, but sort of told you so. I don't mean it like that at all. But I remember I have watched so many games of rugby, a very famous one in 2009 in South Africa, second test, British Lions versus South Africa, when Brian O'Driscoll, arguably one of the greatest players who's ever played for the British and Irish Lions, takes a hit in the head, which, how it didn't remove his head, I will never know. And Drico will tell you now that he feels very lucky in his career, that he hasn't had a long-term injury, because what we're seeing is that there are a number of players who took similar type of hits, and it's really, really bad news. One of the things that I also feel, and maybe this will be the spur for World Rugby, who've definitely got their hands full, particularly as a new CEO is going to be appointed shortly, is that one of the reasons I was very supportive of the Sevens coming into the Olympic movement to try and help internationalise the game is that the game of rugby sevens is largely not about contact. It's about space, and it's about speed, and it's about distance. It's playground rugby. It's tag rugby. It's touch rugby with tackling, and therefore has a much broader appeal with parents all over the world, because it's a game of skill played by boys and girls and can be played. And if
interesting.
And if rugby wants to be the universal sport that the IOC wants it to be, they need to start properly funding rugby sevens, because rugby sevens, the risk is significantly less. And it's also, for those who are not initiated into the game of 15s, like someone like I am, it's the game I played, it's very easy to watch. It's a very easy spectacle. But if rugby doesn't embrace sevens now formally, they put bugger all real investment into it compared to the rest of the game. With what's coming down the track, with genuine fear now of this isn't one isolated incident. There are a number of players now who are having serious dementia, early stage dementia, etc. There's a problem brewing because the game has...
Big problem.
The physicality of the game is eye-watering. And I, as you know, from the captain's table, I've had a lot of former rugby players on the show and will have in the future. Some of the greatest of all time have been on the show. And they will privately tell you they find the modern game terrifying. The sheer physicality,
really,
particularly around the head area. It just didn't happen before.
Well, I don't know where this story, the dominoes fall. You know, we've got a precedent with the NFL and, you know, we saw what happened there. There's a pattern. There's denial at the governing body at the start. That's the same of the FA. We saw that dreadful letter that was sent by Jeff Astle's wife to the English FA and the horrible reply that the lawyers gave her, a woman that had just... had that tragedy. The NFL did the same and then eventually lost, and there was the Will Smith film about that. Does rugby, Giles, Grant, does rugby have the means to not combat it, to deal with this, to manage this? Because, I mean, honestly, if you take rugby out of the schools, because that's where it comes from, it's not a mass participation thing like football is. It needs, I think, schools. And if you've got a teacher saying, I can't tell parents that I'm letting their kids do this, I think it dies pretty quickly. You know, like, so how do these dominoes fall?
Well, it's a great question, Roger, and I'm not a soothsayer. And a lot of the criticism on the governing bodies has been, why didn't you do anything? And it's always easy to say after the event or during, you know, people didn't know at the time to the level. Or if they did, it wasn't looked at hard enough. What I do think, where a lot of where a lot of the problems started, back in the day, probably when any of us, if we played rugby, it was a 15-a-side game. And you might have had a couple of reserves, but they were only really used for injury. So you had to play the full 80 minutes. And playing a full game of 80 minutes of any sport requires a level of fitness, which means you don't want to carry all the bulk in the world. And my view is this, is that because rugby allowed seven substitutes, eight substitutes, whatever it is now, and they're used tactically, it's not about injury, it's simply about tactics, is you're getting huge people coming on for 50 minutes and then them coming off and impact players coming in for the final 30 minutes. And it is that bulk and size and power that was, I think, a lot of the precipitant of the actually brutality that rugby has created, and sheer physicality, when in the past, if you were much more than 17 stone, you were the fat lad that couldn't get round the park, and in the last 20 minutes, you were no good for the game because you needed to be up where the ball was at. The game now doesn't require, a lot of players don't need to play for more than 45, 50 minutes, and that changes the physicality. And if I were, God, I'm not a rule maker and I'll probably get shouted down, but I think the first thing that they should be looking at is changing the substitution to reduce the size of players, to say, well, you're on the pitch for 80 minutes, that's going to require a physicality which is more about endurance rather than sheer power, because I think that's where a lot of it has come from. But I think your point is right, Rog, these headlines are not going to go away, and particularly in a very risk-averse culture that we live in now, and you're a school, and you're saying, well, we proudly have had a rugby tradition of 100 years, and now we're seeing all of this evidence coming that the game is dangerous. And remember, young men and young women, but particularly young men who are 17 years old playing at schools or whatever, they're pretty physical now. They're pretty
huge.
They're beefed up kids. They're big kids. They have scrum caps on. You're going to see a lot of schools go, no thanks.
Well, that's the point. You know, these certainly the private schools, the fee-paying schools, they're businesses. They are nothing other than businesses. And that is not a risk that they will want to take for well-heeled parents who know a lot of smart lawyers. You're going to stop rugby pretty damn quick, Giles.
And you know the trouble is, and sport often, and we've heard this actually, we've heard this on this show, we've heard this on Captain's Table, even in light and jest. One of the problems that sports often has is a macho side, which is we never dared say anything or we never change anything because you'd be considered somehow to be a wimp. You know, training sessions have to be bloody and gory or whatever they may be. And in a sense, rugby perhaps has suffered from that. It's the ultimate macho game. It's a hard, hard game. But with this increased physicality, players who perhaps said, you know, maybe enough is enough, they'd never get asked to play again. And there's this kind of circle that has spun faster and faster out of control. And what I hope happens is that rather than it being the end of rugby 15 aside and it gets caught in a witch hunt of, as you talk about, which is possible, Rog, is actually the game really takes stock of itself and says, okay, we understand that head injuries are dangerous. We've now got very real proof and that we really need to take a proper hard look at all of the elements which can reduce that, which isn't just about things like the tackle, which they are working very hard on. This is not a criticism of any of the unions in World Rugby because they've tried. But now they're faced with something which is if they don't change, it's not going to be, well, a few less people are playing. If the pipeline goes,
that's right,
the game is over in a generation
and a half. Gents, let's think about the last two conversations we've had here because I find it ironic in many ways. You know, we're talking about rugby, and let's face it, we know what the fans love to see, right, Charles? They love to see those big hits. And the replays are the big hits, right? They love to see that. And yet we're talking now in an escalating fashion about safety. At the same time as the hot sport is basically untrained people getting in a square when the whole aim is to take the other person's head off, and they're going in against professionals, so you know, if you think about what this is telling us, what the crowd wants, sadly, is the head injuries, is the people punching, you know, knocking out the Nate Robinsons of the world, right, and seeing them flat on their face.
And didn't the Romans know that? Baying
for
blood.
Absolutely right.
And it's as old as time, and therefore it has to be up to the sporting rights holders to manage that, because they're the only people who can manage it, because the fans won't manage it, because the fans always want the entertainment. And you're quite right. Someone having their heads, I remember in the 80s, we all do, those of us old enough to remember, and we three are, but to watch Mike Tyson fight in his pomp in the 80s was to me, without doubt, the most exciting visceral sport I've ever seen in my life. And nothing has come close. But my God, when he talked about him wanting to kill people, even though you didn't want anybody to die, quite obviously, there was something in that menace that you kind of wanted to see.
Absolutely. I mean, rugby, the head injuries are accidental. It is expressly forbidden to target, you know, certain parts of the body, including the head. So the injuries there are accidental. But boxing, the whole aim is to punch the guy in the head as hard as you can and knock him unconscious. I mean, I just find it interesting that at the same time that we're having all these, you know, discussions about head injuries, whether it's in rugby or whether it's in football, we've got the massive upsurge in popularity of untrained boxers who just happen to be celebrities and influencers being encouraged and paid millions to get in the ring and have their heads ripped off.
Well, that's the point, Grant. It's just as I always say, follow the money. Just follow the money. The reason that rugby, I think, has got a problem that it needs to think about like tomorrow morning is what I said. Parents at fancy schools going to sue private businesses and they're going to say, I don't need that. Just follow the money. That's a money decision that will hurt a sport, as Jill says, at the start of its pipeline. The other one is loads of money in celebrity boxing. That's fine. You know, I'm just a great believer. You say I don't have a filter. I'm just a great believer in calling out the truth. The truth is that it's exactly what you both said. The gladiators, it's Hunger Games and it's money. And everything else is a little bit of a comfort blanket to make us feel better. But that's what's going to drive the sports industry going forward.
Which takes me back to Running Man, and whilst you both, you know, deride me for watching it, you watch that film, and I hope everybody does. I just watch it again. It's, you can see some sports going down that absurdity, and where does it stop in extremis? I don't mean it will go to Running Man, but my goodness, it, for the sake of entertainment, what
Running
price?
Man, Rollerball. I mean, yeah, there's been plenty of these dystopian views of sport in the future, Giles, and who knows where it goes, but we seem to be in a period where we're going towards less contact, less violence, less extremism than more.
So let's go breakdancing.
Yeah, there you go. No, listen, I say Morris dancing. No one ever got hurt Morris dancing, except maybe.
Oh no, you can
hanky
get
in the
you
eye.
Can get a rap get on the knuckle. The you eye. Can get yeah. a rap hanky in the eye and a bell somewhere else.
Well, gents, listen. The, as I have to say, our lunch hour is almost at a close. Anything else we need to chew the fat over before we go back to work?
I think we better get back to work, Grant.
Well, sadly, I think you're right. All that remains, I guess, is to thank you out there for listening to us. As always, we really appreciate each and every one of you, and we appreciate the support you give the show. And please do take a moment to rate and review us on iTunes and share the podcast with your friends. It'll help us find a bigger audience. In the meantime, we'll be back. You can follow us on Twitter. In the meantime, you'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word A-R-E. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
And you can find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And you can find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, off we go. See you next time.
See you. Thanks, everyone.